Where the Missouri River passes by the River Market area, low trees and vegetation line muddy waters, and cars rumble across bridges on their daily commutes. There's a walking trail along the train tracks, but hundreds of years ago, this was the site of a rock ledge at the base of a steep hill. It was just wide enough for a horse and rider to pass, and this rock ledge is where the city began. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to begin on this rock ledge as well. Our guest is going to tell us the story of how one geological anomaly shaped the fate of Kansas City. Richard J. Gentile, Professor Emeritus from KU's Department of Geology, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Well, first of all, what is a rock ledge?
Well, a rock ledge, the one along the south bank of the Missouri River, we call it the Bethany Falls. It's about 20 feet thick. It underlies the entire greater Kansas City area, just like a page in a book. It was named for a exposure up near the town of Bethany, which is about 100 miles northeast of Kansas City. But an early geologist, Garland C. Broadhead, he was studying the rock formations throughout the state. And, of course, there was a nice waterfall there at Bethany. And the local people, they would come there with their horses and wagons, and they'd have a picnic. And so he named it the Bethany Falls. Now, the geologists, we name rock ledges after geographic locations. So Bethany, of course, was a small town there. And then that particular rock bed, now it extends all the way from Iowa throughout Nebraska into the greater Kansas City area here.
So this is the rock ledge, but what is a rock ledge? I mean, for people who just aren't familiar with that terminology.
Well, a rock ledge, by a geological definition, is a layer of rock that can be traced for a great distance. And, of course, the Bethany Falls fit those particular dimensions. And it's about 20 feet thick, and all of the underground mines in the greater Kansas City area, most quarries are in that Bethany ledge because it's a high-calcium limestone, and it's quite valuable.
Our story begins in the 1830s, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, in 1831.
So what was already here? I mean, before Kansas City proper, like, got started in earnest, what was already going on here?
Well, downtown Kansas City wasn't there. It was a wilderness area with deep gorges, 30, 40 feet deep. It was almost impassable. But the major town was Westport. And Westport had a few houses there. There was a warehouse there. It was one run by a young entrepreneur by the name of John Calvin McCoy. He's later called the father of Kansas City. He owned the warehouse, and, of course, he supplied the wagon trains that were going to Santa Fe to trade with the Spaniards. Now, one of the advantages of Westport, there's two or three large springs which emit from underneath a limestone bed, which we call the Argentine, and those springs, they emitted thousands of gallons of fresh water. And the covered wagons, they could load up their water barrels before they headed southwest to Santa Fe in there.
What's going on with those springs now? I've never visited a spring in Westport.
Well, the springs are still there, but they've piped them under. If you go there along certain areas, there's a park there where you can look through one of the grates and you can see the water bubbling down there.
But I mean, I kind of want to do this.
Well, that would be a nice way to spend an afternoon hunting for some of the former springs. That's a good geological project there. But anyway, Westport was also about 2 miles from Indian Territory. And an early English explorer went through Kansas in about the 17th century. It was a dried-up wasteland. He called it the Great American Desert. He wrote that down on his map, and he went home. So up until after the Civil War, many people who were going west, they thought they were entering a desert. And so, of course, they would stock up from this fellow's warehouse. But the major port of entry then was Independence, but they would unload their supplies at Independence. They would put them on various types of ox-drawn carts and horse-drawn carts, and then they would pass through Independence. There was 150 people living there then. But then they would continue overland to Westport. That was a trip of about 25 miles. And, of course, even in good weather, that took at least 2 days.
And, wow.
And was back in the days when, of course, they had a trail going through there. But anyway, one of your major obstacles was the Blue River. And if the Blue River wasn't flooded, they had to wait there sometimes for days before they could ford the river. So this young entrepreneur, John Calvin McCoy, he asked the captain of the John Hancock, which was a steamboat coming up the river, if he would just throw his supplies out along the bank of the river just below where the Kaw, they call it the Kaw, I guess they still do, it's the Kansas River, just below it. He said, throw my supplies out on the south bank of the river, I'll come down and collect them. And so that's what happened. Well, he came down through one of the gorges. There was three deep gorges that led down to the riverfront there. And he came down with three teams of oxen. He may have had to cut down a few trees to get down there, but anyway, he picked up his supplies, and there was that rock ledge there, which was really a natural wharf.
I want to get right back to this rock ledge because I know it's sort of the star of this show, but there's something that we've kind of passed over that intrigues me a bit, this idea that downtown Kansas City used to be a dense forest. Can
yes.
you tell me more about that? I mean, that is pretty weird to think about. We're discussing urban history, but I'm curious about the natural history of this place. If the city hadn't been built on the rock ledge, might we still be surrounded by forest right now?
Well, I doubt that. You see, the first major city was the town of Kansas, which was built on that rock ledge there. As you mentioned, it was only wide enough there for a horse and rider to move on. That's when they first used it in 1833. But they needed more room, of course, as more riverboats came up. And so they would dig into the bluff there, which is covered mostly by soft wind-blown silt and clay. And so whenever they needed a place for another building, they would just dig into the bluff with shovels and dump it right into the river. And so after a few years, they had a wharf there, which was about 400 or 500 feet wide and about half a mile long. And it was a stable platform where they could build a small city. But as I mentioned, downtown Kansas City was a deep gorges. And city gradually moved up onto the area where downtown Kansas City is now, but of course they had a lot of various construction to do there. I mean, one of the early settlers, a fellow by the name of Case, he said that whenever we needed a flat place to build a building, to put in a building, we would just push a hill into a valley. And some places they had to remove at least 90 feet of loose sediment up there.
So the whole topography of the city that we now know used to be, it sounds like, just dramatically different.
Yeah, once these construction crews finished their work there in what is now downtown Kansas City, the lay of the land was changed forever. What you see there now wasn't what Lewis and Clark saw.
Can you describe to the best of your ability what Lewis and Clark saw?
Well, what they saw there, of course, I think they camped near the confluence of the Missouri and Kaw Rivers, but I don't know if they ever came up there on the ledge. But the area, which is downtown Kansas City, it was deep ravines, at least 30, 40 feet deep, and it was completely covered by trees and brush. And so it wasn't nobody ever believed they would ever build a city there. Because, you see, once they landed on that rock ledge down there and they unloaded their supplies, they had to get up the bluff, and that was over 100 feet high. And, of course, during times of rain, it was pretty slippery. So evidently they thought, well, we'll probably never build a city there.
But so this guy, John Calvin McCoy, he has the idea that he's going to have someone toss his supplies onto the rock ledge. He's going to get down there, and he's going to build a wharf?
No, he didn't build a wharf. I mean, most likely that rock ledge was probably known a lot earlier, but you see, the traffic was local. I know they had some dealings with Clay County, which, of course, was established, I think, in the 1820s. But these were all local small boats and canoes. These river boats that began coming up the river, like the John Hancock, they had supplies that they probably collected throughout the world. I mean, if you remember the steamboat Arabia, which, of course, sank in 1859, there's a beautiful exhibit in downtown Kansas City now.
Yeah, a whole museum for it.
Yeah, well, what they were carrying was various types of beautiful things like tools and that from all over the world. And so these riverboats were coming up. There were thousands of them. But you see, over a period of 75 years, there were thousands of these riverboats tied up along that particular ledge down there. And they unloaded their supplies there, and on that, a town of Kansas built there. Little information here about the town of Kansas now. But it was John Calvin McCoy and a group of businessmen, they bought that particular stretch of the riverfront down there from the relatives of a Frenchman who had been killed in a saloon brawl.
Whoa.
And so what they did is they divided up that ledge into lots, and they named the place the town of Kansas, and then, of course, they began selling lots in there. But years later, John Calvin McCoy, he wrote that a few men with no capital bought the land. They bought the land, and because it had a good steamboat landing and was the most suitable starting point for caravans to New Mexico, the idea that any one of them would live to see a city among these precipitous cliffs and impassable gorges never entered into their calculations. It seemed in retrospect that nature had exhausted her resources in a grand effort to thwart the city builders. Not only were the town founders faced with topographical difficulties, but these difficulties were for many years seized upon by our neighboring villages to wound our sensibilities and lacerate our feelings, and added insult to injury by applying to our small town the low, humiliating term gully town. That's what they call it because they had to cut these deep gorges to get up onto the upland and onto Westport.
Richard, I want to jump in because, yeah, there is a whole chapter on this rock ledge in your book, Rocks and Fossils of the Central United States, with emphasis on the greater Kansas City area. And in that chapter, you've got this photograph from 1871 that shows what was then called the town of Kansas, as we've explained, sitting on the rock ledge around modern-day Main Street and Delaware Street. You've got multi-story buildings clustered very close together with cliffs surrounding them. It would appear that the topography here is keeping development contained in a pretty close space, and therefore it's kind of dense and consolidated. When and how did that change? I mean, that is so not how we think of Kansas City today.
Well, gradually, of course, they could only make that particular ledge so wide, and it was about 400 or 500 feet wide, that's my estimate. But then the city gradually moved up onto the bluff through these great gorges that were cutting through in here. But in 1850s and by 1840s, 1850s, the town of Kansas, here's some of the things that they had there, had 40 manufacturers, including 5 sawmills, 3 brickyards, 2 grain mills, blacksmith and wagon maker, 16 hotels. The largest hotel was the Gillis Hotel. It was several stories high, about 100 rooms, 27,000 visitor stayed in that hotel in 1857, 1858. There was also 16 other hotels, but they were small, probably one-room things.
Who was staying in these places? I mean, who were these travelers?
Well, these were people who were coming from, usually from out of places like Virginia, in Tennessee, in Georgia, but there was a crisis as far as land. The price of land was greatly depressed, and these people were looking for a new homeland. And so at least a third of the people in some of those eastern states just packed up and went westward because they had, of course, free land there, 160 acres.
Was theirs
to take. But you see, on this rock ledge, there was also 26 saloons, a large number of gambling houses. The population was estimated to be 4,000, but in 1850...
So people were having a really good time, 4,000 people and 26 saloons and a bunch of gambling houses?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what they did back in those days. They had a lot of gambling houses and saloons. That's how that Frenchman got killed and John Calvin McCoy got the land.
It all comes full circle.
Yeah. You see, in 1857, there were 750 steamers docked on the wharf. And sometimes there'd be several of them lined up there to unload. And the following year, 60 passenger-carrying boats made scheduled stops. But that rock ledge was well known. You see, a visitor in 1857, he wrote, "The steamboat landing is perhaps the best on the Missouri River. In fact, the entire riverfront constitutes a natural wharf where any kind of vessel might discharge and pick up freight safely." Still had other comments. They had many comments about that rock ledge. They said, one lady, she said, "Providence has favored us with an all-weather wharf. The rock ledge has been called the Plymouth Rock of Kansas City, the rock ledge upon which the city is built, Kansas City's birthstone, and they've also called it the Rosetta Stone," and so it had a lot of names. But I might add that this town of Kansas was not an aesthetic place. A visitor in the 1850s recalled the town quite clearly. He said, "In the Western world, it took very little to make a city, if this was to be called one. The scene on the landing was depressing. Houses planted against a bluff, narrow streets jammed with wagons, cattle wandering in great numbers to be sold to immigrants. The line of shabby warehouses along the levee and assorted saloons, dry goods, and grocery stores strung out between Wyandotte and Walnut Streets, the bluff behind them covered with weeds, brush, and dead trees."
I am so surprised, though, that this was not a pretty place, because this, up until this moment, it has sounded very pretty. Like, I'm sad that we don't still have cliffs, kind of.
Well, it was. In one way, it was a nice place by the activity that was going on. You see, this one fellow wrote, he said, "The sights along the levee were not easily resisted," he said. "The levee with its three or four steamers unloading large piles of Mexican freight, prairie schooners, mules, greasers, Indians, Negroes, mud clerks, Frenchmen, emigrants, old settlers, tenderfeet, hotel drummers, brass bands were playing on the ledge." The town of Kansas was a frontier boom town.
Hold that thought. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll get right back to the story of how geology shaped our city back in the day. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a question about the rock ledge where it all began. That's 816-235-2888. You'll be talking with a professor emeritus of geology from KU. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in just a minute. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Richard J. Gentile, professor emeritus from KU's Department of Geology and ultimate expert on the rock formations of our area. It turns out that our city's origins can be traced back to a rock ledge just wide enough for a horse and rider to pass. Call 816-235-2888 if you have questions about that story. Richard, you were just saying that Kansas City, that the town of Kansas, which became Kansas City, was a boom town. What do you mean by that?
Well, as I mentioned, there was just to give you an idea here, there were 60 caravans of several of these prairie schooners. In 1 year, they landed on that rock ledge, and then they climbed the bluff and then on to Westport. That was the only way they could go. It was the only route. But some of these wagon trains were 3 miles long. And an interesting incident happened there. There was a young fella, he wanted to get across Kansas as fast as he could, so he put a large sail on a prairie schooner. And the winds were favorable, and he got across Kansas in 2 days. But he got into eastern Colorado, and the wind took his contraption, destroyed it. But in those 2 days, going across Kansas, he passed 40 wagon trains strung out across Kansas. So that'll give you an idea of what was going on. So many of those wagon trains came off of that rock ledge.
Richard, before we pick up with this story, why did you think it was an important one to tell? I mean, what did you hope that ordinary Kansas Cityans might do with this information? Do you think it changes people's relationship with the city to know the story of this rock ledge?
Well, the main reason, it's rocks, and I'm a geologist. But you see, in about 2000 to 2004, we constructed a geologic map of the Kansas City area. It included downtown Kansas City, and students, of course, were involved in this. And we looked for rocks. You need rocks if you're going to draw a map. And so we were looking along the bank of the river there, and we found a small patch of the Bethany Falls limestone that was still exposed. It was about 6 feet thick and about 50 feet long, but it was covered by about 30 feet of loose fill material. In 1951, if you remember, we had a large flood here, and as a flood control measure, the Corps of Engineers covered up the rock ledge with about 30 feet of fill material, but it's still there. It would be nice if they could somehow mark that particular spot there with a plaque, or even if they could construct a stairway going down to it and probably make this into a historic site. It is part of early Kansas City. I've talked to the Riverfront Commission and also the Port Authority. Perhaps someday they may do something with that rock ledge down there, but I don't think it's going to be very soon before they do anything with it.
You know, with knowing the geology of and the natural history of this particular spot as well as you do, when you watch the way we build on it today and the way we use it today, is there anything, I mean, do you think that we're using this land well?
Well, evidently, you know, the town of Kansas is no more. It's just a footnote in history books is all. There's a railroad now coming through. If you go down there, you'll hear the rumble of the trains coming through. And there's a very beautiful riverfront park. If you like to go bicycling, that's the place to go. But, of course, there's nothing left of the town of Kansas. But one of the problems they had there, of course, was floods. I mean, in 1844, the flood, it wiped out the town of Kansas. There was only one building left. But they came right back, and they built it back up again. And, of course, these early Kansas Cityans, they had many problems. There was a cholera epidemic that stopped the westward movement of prairie schooners for over a year. Hundreds of them died from typhoid fever. They endured an awful civil war, but yet they kept coming back, and they kept plotting westward, and they built a nation that spreads from sea to sea. So you have to give them a lot of credit for what they did.
As a scientist, where do you think the natural world should fit into our city planning? I mean, do you think we should be looking at our cities more through a lens of its natural resources?
Well, there's a lot here. I mean, you've got a lot of good geology. I know that. I mean, we have rock formations that are probably some of the best in the world. I mean, you can see them along the road cuts. You can also see units such as the Bethany Falls there. It's exposed, and it's a good place to study geology. But, of course, that's my field. It's geology. I don't know much about building a city, but, of course, there's plenty of places to put in a city. And as far as some of the geology goes, you know, Kansas City is noted for its vastness of underground space. There's over 5 square miles that have been mined out under the city in that Bethany Falls limestone. And there are several thousand people who work underground in those mines now. And so the geology, of course, has done a lot to shape this city, and especially that Bethany Ledge. The city is really built around that Bethany Falls limestone because it's one of your major units used in construction. But there are also several other rock layers now. There are several rock layers that you can see along exposures along the bluffs. But in the early days of Kansas City, just about every block had two or three quarries. And they quarried some of the natural stone, and they built their streets, and they built their buildings out of them. You can go along many streets in Kansas City and see the rock buildings that they built there. And so geology played a major part in the building of our city.
Are you from around here?
Well, I was born in St. Louis. I've been here since 1966. I taught my first course in the summer of 1966, so you can figure out how long I've been here.
How and when did you get into geology?
Well, I got into geology when I was in my 20s. I was looking for a major. I wanted to get into something that had to do with the earth, and I wasn't much of a farmer. And so someone told me, why don't you try geology? So I took a course, and I just loved it. And so I've been with it the rest of my life.
Do you remember what you loved about it?
Well, I just like to be out in the field. You see, a geologist can spend much of his time out in the field hiking and looking at rocks and trying to make interpretations of what he sees, but he also, in bad weather, he can spend that time in the office. And so you're not tied to an office, or you're not tied to having to fight the weather out in the all of the year.
A lot of people might be tempted to focus their research on some faraway place with a lot of travel opportunity and maybe a little more prestige internationally. You know what I mean? What inspired you to stay close to home in your research?
Well, one of the reasons, I just like the geology around here. I mean, we have probably some of the best geology in the world because we have these thin units. From the floodplain of the Missouri River to the top of the highest hill, you probably have two or three dozen units in here.
What do you mean by a unit?
Well, it's a rock layer, and some of them are marine and some of them are non-marine. But what you're interpreting there is a transgression of seas that once spread from West Texas to the foot of the rising Appalachian Mountains over in Pennsylvania, and they were laid down in vast seas, and then the seas would retreat, and then deltas would build out and lay down layers of mud, and then you had another sea advance. Trying to interpret these is a major challenge. This is what I like about doing geology. It's the thrill of trying to unravel the history that went back about 300 million years. That's when these rock ledges like the Bethany Falls were laid down.
Let's talk to a caller. Michael in Midtown wants to join our conversation. Hi, Michael.
Hello there. My question is on the I read a book about 4 years ago, and it was academically written. It was called The Magic Circle, and it had Kansas City area right about the middle of Magic Circle. It emphasized that there were seven different inland seas here, and they all left their geology after they retreated and went back. But I wondered, and I can't find anything on that book. It was a well-written academic text. It's just fascinating to read. It talked about the Arkansas River being a river that was under the sea, and it was, I guess it runs along something there, but it was just a very fascinating book. Do you know anything about it, and
no.
Is it still a respectable book?
Well, I don't know. It sounds like it's a little far out, but I mean,
The idea of a magic circle.
Well, if you want to read about the geologic history of the greater Kansas City, I'd buy my book. It was put out by the University of Kansas, the Paleontological Institute. It's a very reliable group over there.
And it seems like there's something exciting about the idea of being in something that we would call a magic circle. I don't know.
Well, what we really, I think what he's referring to there is a time when seas once covered this area. You see, there were shallow seas that repeatedly transgressed and regressed across the interior of the continent. You're going back about 300 million years in our time scale. And of course, those seas entered where the Rocky Mountains are now. The Rocky Mountains weren't there. They came millions of years later. And of course, these seas entered through low-lying passageways, and then they spread across the interior of the continent. And then, of course, they would retreat, and you'd get deltas building out. And so we were near the equator then, you see. The continents were all together, forming a large landmass called Pangaea. And so we had a tropical, a subtropical climate. And, of course, with all the continents together, of course, there was a lot going on. Of course, the Appalachian Mountains were forming, so were the Ouachita Mountains. And the land surface may have been moving up and down, allowing seas to transgress and regress. But that, of course, is a long story.
Yeah, I mean, a very long story. But, you know, your book, it talks about some other rocks and fossils that in this area. Are there others that get top billing, other than the rock ledge that we've been talking about today?
Well, if you want to talk about fossils, I mean, one of your world-class groups of fossils were found right here in downtown Kansas City at 11th and Grand Avenue. In 1889, we were putting in a large store there. It covered almost a city block, called the Emery Bird Thayer Building, and at a depth of several feet, they had a thin bed of shale, which is tremendously fossiliferous. The fossil that they found in there is called a crinoid. Some people call them sea lilies, but they look like a lily, but of course they're really like a starfish on a stem. But they collected, early fossil hunters collected about 400 of those slabs with those fossils on it. And there are museums throughout the eastern United States and in Europe. And so we have a major group of fossils, of world-class fossils, that were found right here in downtown Kansas City at 11th and Grand Avenue in about 1889, whenever they were constructing that particular basement. But back in those days, things went a lot slower, and they used picks and shovels to dig up the formations, and they'd rip up great big slabs of shale, and on those slabs they would find these fossils in a perfect state of preservation. Downtown Kansas City, back during what we call the Pennsylvanian period, about 300 million years ago, was a shallow sea. And it just teemed with life, and conditions for preservation were just really marvelous there. And so we have these fossils that have made their way throughout the world.
Do you have a favorite story or character from the days when the town of Kansas was really consolidated onto that rock ledge?
Favorite person?
Yeah, just a...
Well, I mean, John Calvin McCoy, he's the one who started it all. And, of course, he's called the father of Kansas City. And he was well known, of course, and he went on, and I think he lived until about 1889, but he helped build the city. And but as I mentioned, the town of Kansas then gradually moved up onto the upland.
Richard J. Gentile, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Coming up, stained glass. Once upon a time, it was nearly banned, but artists are still making it today. Plus, local musicians paid homage to David Bowie at the Uptown Theater last night. We'll take you there on our way out. Those stories are next on KCUR's Central Standard.